For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time once again for This Week in Oklahoma Politics with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. Well, the state Supreme Court rules the governor is justified in withholding some documents from the public. This stems from a lawsuit filed more than 2 years ago over 100 documents withheld by the Fallon administration over her decision of the Affordable Care Act. Ryan, it's a loss for the ACLU, but is there a silver lining here as well?
Well, you know, I think that it's the best of a bad situation. If you obviously we're disappointed that the Supreme Court found that these privileges existed at all. But once they did, at least they put in an element of judicial oversight and some independent accountability for the governor's office. You know, before this lawsuit, the governor's office was essentially withholding these documents and other documents and unrelated requests regarding criminal justice reform and a number of other issues. And when they were withholding them and you asked them why they were privileged, essentially their answer was because we say that they are. And you know, when we file this now, at least there is some judicial accountability. They have a burden to demonstrate why there is a privilege. And even if there is a privilege, that can be overcome by showing a public interest. However, let's be very clear. This is still a bad situation, whether it was the former system or the system that we have after this opinion, where journalists and reporters are going to have to go to court to overcome this assertion of a new privilege that the executive branch has come up with.
Is there concern about an abuse of power for any governor that's sitting in the office?
Well, I think you can always attempt to make that argument, but I think the court ruled and said what many have said all along, and that is that executive privilege not only comes from just common law, but it's an inherent power of the governor. And I thought it was interesting that they went back and pointed out the fact that they said an Oklahoma governor had no less need than the president of the United States to receive candid, objective opinion and information from, you know, from their folks that are in the executive branch, and that should be done and solicited with confidentiality. And I think let's go back to the point you said 100 pages. It was 100 pages out of 51,000 pages mm-hmm. related to the ACA issue about programs and funding. So I think we're talking about isolated examples. I think it is a good news situation in that it did clarify what was really being talked about. And I think the justices were right in coming down in favor of Governor Fallon's position.
It's really going to be incumbent upon the ACLU and media organizations around the state, though, I think, to aggressively push for the release of records in the wake of this decision, because if we don't, then I think that future case law could create an exception so big that you could drive a truck through it.
And it was pressure that actually did lead to her releasing most of those 51,000.
And I think what pressure tends to work in political situations with elected officials. So I think it's incumbent upon them to make sure that they are acting within the confines of what the law is. And if they don't, there is a process, and there certainly is the Fourth Estate that's going to aggressively pursue making sure that those documents are released. And that's been the history in our country.
Yes, we will. And staying on the subject of the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, Governor Fallon is accepting $2 million under the ACA for Oklahoma to develop innovative models for delivering health care. Neva, do you foresee any problems with her accepting Obamacare money?
Well, anytime you put money and Obamacare and accepting all of those words in the same sentence, you probably have a little bit of pushback from a lot of Oklahomans. And I think it is, to me, it was surprising a couple of things. First of all, the total in the grant monies was something like $660 million. We're talking about $2 million, a drop in the bucket in Oklahoma, for a program that really is about four of the most pervasive health problems in our state, and that's obesity, diabetes, hypertension, and tobacco use. Those are issues that the governor cares about. Whether or not going this road to use this grant money, which is really just a starting place, where do you go once you get these things going? And that $2 million probably evaporates very quickly in the scheme of developing any kind of program, innovative or not. So, I think she has done a good job of assembling a team of both public and private sector folks to participate in this, and I do applaud that, because I think that was well thought out and works well. It's just a question of where does the money come from, and this attachment to ACA certainly is a problem.
Ryan, what are your thoughts?
I think this is good news, but I agree with Neva that the money is going to evaporate quickly. $2 million is an important investment in the healthcare of Oklahomans, We have over 150,000 Oklahomans that are languishing without health insurance because the governor continues her refusal to expand Medicaid in the state of Oklahoma, leaving over 150,000 Oklahomans without any health insurance whatsoever. We rejected over $50 million to create a state-run exchange in the state of Oklahoma. You know, this is, I think, a hopeful sign that the governor is beginning to see that the Affordable Care Act is the engine that she needs to fulfill a promise that she's made to improve the health of Oklahomans. That's where she's been talking about this, and a very quick and easy way to do that would be to expand Medicaid and bring 150,000 people of Oklahoma into the healthcare system rather than languishing on the sidelines.
And I think that's the problem. I don't think there's any relationship between that $2 million grant acceptance and expanding in the area that you're talking about, Ryan. I mean, she's been very emphatic throughout the campaign as well as during the last legislative session about this, and it would be a pretty radical departure to come back around now, even though, no question, there's going to be more and more pressure because of the limited number of dollars out there and the fact that these services have to be provided in some fashion to these folks that are in need of that medical care and are not going to get those Medicaid services or what they might be entitled to.
But it's never too late to admit you're wrong, and I won't. You know, if the governor,
speaking from a former politician,
yeah,
now.
it's not. If the governor expands Medicaid, I'm going to be so grateful and happy that these 150,000 plus Oklahomans are going to be able to go to a doctor instead of worrying about losing their job and their entire livelihood if they get hurt or sick or injured at work or wherever. I pledge on KOSU today that I will not tell the governor I told you so. I'll just welcome it with open arms.
The state Supreme Court killed a part of the 2011 tort reform law, which basically punished uninsured drivers. The policy called No Pay, No Play restricted some damage awards for drivers who don't have insurance, and that was struck down. Ryan, your thoughts on this ruling?
Big news. Helps Oklahomans across the board, but in particular low and middle-income Oklahomans. You know, the plaintiff in this case actually thought that she had liability insurance. She thought somebody else was paying for it. It turns out they weren't. She didn't have health. She didn't have the liability insurance. And unless the Supreme Court did what they did in this case, she would have been precluded from getting any damages from an accident that was not her fault. It's amazing to me, although it's not surprising, it's amazing that the legislature continues to punish low-income and middle-income Oklahomans while trying to help out their insurance buddies. And that's what this did, and the Supreme Court stepped in and said, no, you're not going to do that.
This was a big platform piece, Neva, for the Republicans when they passed this in 2011. Do you think there's going to be some bite back toward the Supreme Court because of this?
I think there will be. I think you would have to expect that at this point. And I think it's not about punishing low-income or middle-income folks. It's about a view of what is proper with respect to insurance and the law. And I think I think it will be revisited. I mean, this is one of those instances where, again, as we say with many of these court tests and court cases, there are really two very defined views of how this should go, and the court's taken one view, and I think we'll see a number of Republicans probably ramp it up and want to revisit this in the next session.
It's been a busy week for the Supreme Court. As early this week, justices upheld a $120 million bond to fix the Capitol. Neva, state leaders have got to be pretty excited to start work on the crumbling building at 23rd.
Oh, absolutely. And I think the good news is it was a unanimous decision. The one-page order basically just said that this is not an illegal special law. It wasn't contrary to anything. And to move forward, and even though there's been a slight delay of a few weeks, it does appear, based on what the Capitol Project Manager said earlier this week, that the exterior work will begin in the spring, which means that would keep them on schedule to have interior work beginning in 2016 as originally planned. So, I mean, this is long overdue. I think everyone applauds this and looks forward to the day when we can all go back to the Capitol and not see scaffolding outside and have all of the attendant issues inside that they've had to deal with for far too long.
Ryan.
By those attendant issues, are we talking about the current majorities? Because that's not going away with the bonds.
No, that's not.
I think that what we've seen in the media on this deal is a lot of folks justifying the outcome of the Supreme Court case based on the necessity for the Capitol repairs. I think we all agree that the Capitol's crumbling. It needs to be repaired in some fashion. But it is important to remember that the prohibition on special laws in our state's constitution doesn't just serve this arcane purpose. One of the reasons that the legislature is prohibited from passing special laws is without having to go through some sort of a process special to those laws is to protect the people of Oklahoma from the legislature. And so if you're going to pass a law that's going to impact a small group of people or one entity, then the people of Oklahoma should have and be afforded some extra notice so that they can show up at the Capitol and either lobby for or against it as they see fit. Regardless of the outcome of this case, I think it's just important to remind ourselves that these things in our Constitution that may seem like that they're artifacts from another century, which they kind of
are, yeah.
They're still relevant in today's jurisprudence and politics.
An investigative piece from Oklahoma Watch found the Department of Corrections secretly changed its policy to reduce prison overpopulation. The report finds the DOC released violent and sexual offenders early, and some of them have returned to jail for murders, robberies, and sexual assaults. Ryan, were you surprised by this report?
Yeah, I think that you've got a director and a department that is under an enormous amount of strain. I mean, our prisons are overpopulated. We have a broken criminal justice system, or maybe as Michelle Alexander, the author, said, it's not a broken criminal justice system. It's doing exactly what it's intended to do. And in Oklahoma, that's incarcerating 28,000 folks thereabouts and over 50,000 in DOC custody overall. So I think that it's not surprising when you end up with these absurd results where people that are convicted of very violent crimes are getting out of prison faster than people that have convicted, you know, lesser crimes. These types of outcomes are really a byproduct of a system that is desperately in need of reform.
Neva?
I agree with Ryan. The reform has to take place because we have a correction system busting at the seams. I mean, we have basically no beds. I mean, we continue to lock people up or have the need to lock people up, and there's just not room. So, I mean, the legislature is going to be forced, like it or not, to have to deal with this situation, and I don't think there's any great groundswell to build more prisons. So what do you do? And I think that's where they're going to have to really get more innovative in dealing with this and make these numbers not look so stark. I mean, when we continue to be number one among men incarcerated, number three, I believe now women still nationally incarcerated. I mean, these are terrible statistics that the only way we're going to deal with them is to get everybody at the table and be realistic. And lawmakers who want to go out and get reelected time and time again on being tough on crime and yet not sitting down and really being realistic about what they're faced mm-hmm. with, it's a real problem that I think is long overdue being addressed.
And we can't just keep going after the low-hanging fruit here. This isn't about making sure that, I mean, Director Patton, one of the reasons that he's letting these folks go is because he thinks that they can get greater rehabilitative services on the outside than they can in prison.
Right.
That's just insane that's the situation that we're in. And we cannot continue to go after low-hanging fruit. We've got to really look at sentencing reform. We've got to look at why we're criminalizing huge segments of our population to begin with.
So not just reducing the number of people in our prisons, but the recidivism rate as well.
And the number and why we're sending people to prison to begin with.
Good deal. Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.